How should parents manage their children's pacifiers?
Recommendations for preventing and screening for lung cancer.
Are supplements of any use at all in age-related macular degeneration?
And if you have one of those implantable defibrillators, can we prevent inappropriate shocks?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 10th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Before we get going on our studies this week, Rick, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to acknowledge a couple of our listeners. So I'm going to let you take the ball from here.
Well, first of all, to Tom and his pathoanatomy class up in Canada, they sent us a picture of the group. We're going to post it on the blog. Thanks for listening. And then one of our listeners, Phil, who's at the APL lab in Baltimore, asked if we would talk about a book called Bad Pharma. This is a good time for listeners that haven't been with us the entire 8 years we've been broadcasting, just to let you know this, what we broadcast about are studies that have been released that week. We don't promo books, but this book by Ben Goldacre I've heard is really good. I've actually ordered it online. But Phil, we appreciate your suggestion.
And there's another book that Tom, the veterinarian you've already mentioned, has sent to me and also that is going to be sent to you as soon as I finish with it, with the same subject material. It's by the former editor of the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, and it's really quite cheeky and British in its humor. So for those of you who don't want to listen to us bandy about what's going on in the medical literature and our opinions, you can get another viewpoint or perhaps a more objective viewpoint by looking at these books. And is not a recommendation. Okay, so this is a recommendation, however. A study that's gotten a huge amount of popular press, that's in pediatrics. It's talking about parents sucking on their children's pacifiers. And we see this so often. They're en route someplace, the pacifier falls out and goes on the floor, and the parent picks it up and sticks it in their mouth and then hands it back to the infant or the child. Good idea? Not good idea? What should we do?
This is so fortuitous because last week we talked about something else related to this, what's called the hygiene hypothesis. If we stimulate the immune system through exposure to microbes, we can actually prevent some of the allergies that may develop. This is hilarious. Babies being exposed to pacifiers that their parents have sucked on. When babies' pacifiers fall on the ground, what do parents do? So they looked at 184 birth cohort children. They did a survey at 6 months and asked their parents, how do you clean the pacifier? And then they looked at 18 and 36 months to determine whether the children had any allergies, whether they had asthma or eczema. What they determined was that the children whose parents cleaned their pacifier by sucking on it were less likely to have asthma, 88% less likely, 63% less likely to have eczema, and about 63% less likely to have sensitization to external allergens at 18 months. And by 36 months, there was still a significant decrease in eczema.
And I do have to share that my pediatrician for my two daughters was a woman who graduated from Johns Hopkins. She was really very much a proponent of into each life, some dirt must fall. And I think we have to give accolades to her memory with this particular study and say, wow, so it's not so bad if you just pick that thing up and suck it off and give it back to the baby.
And my grandmother, who was from Alaska, used to tell me the same thing. You can't grow up unless you've eaten 2 pecks of dirt. And now I know why.
I'm not sure what a peck is, but I'm not sure I want you to explain it to me either. It sounds like something I need a spoon in order to consume. Let's move from here then into a business, actually, that probably nets manufacturers a lot of money every year. That's the idea that supplements, and some of them are kind of strange supplements, may be useful for age-related macular degeneration. The number one cause of blindness, I would just reiterate for folks, in people 55 and older internationally. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And we currently have about 10 million Americans that either have moderate or advanced form of this age-related macular degeneration. We do know that some supplements are beneficial in help preventing it or delaying the progression. There's been a very good study that showed that oral supplementation with a formulation that contains antioxidants, vitamin C and E, beta carotene, and zinc are effective. This study took that formulation and said, if we add fish oils, lutein and zeaxanthin, or both together, can we further decrease the risk of macular degeneration? So over 4,200 individuals received the formulation that has been effective and either placebo or fish oil or the other carotenoids or the fish oil and the carotenoids, and they followed them for the course of about 5 years. And what they determined was that there was no additional benefit to these additional supplements.
The other part of this, as I suggested already, is that these formulations are expensive. It sounds like people ought to just say, forget about it, because these other formulations that we know about already are really inexpensive.
Yeah, and by the way, we're not even going to talk about the fact that this week also, there was another study dispelling the myth that fish oils help prevent cardiovascular disease as well.
We'll just say that for right now, give those supplements a miss. We seem to be saying that a lot more often. Let's turn then to the journal Chest. Recommendations by this organization that folks who are cigarette smokers or former cigarette smokers ought to be getting low-dose CT in order to screen for lung cancer.
This is an extensive look at practice guidelines, what the recommendations are based upon the evidence for the diagnosis and management of lung cancer. I want to focus on three areas. In certain populations, using low-dose CT to screen for lung cancer, that population are individuals that are aged 55 to 74 and that are either current or previous smokers, smoking within the last 15 years, and they have a 30-pack year smoking history. And in these individuals, low-dose CT scanning can detect cancer in its early stages. What about individuals before or after those ages? We don't have any evidence. Now, the two other areas I want to highlight, one is what about prevention? Well, there are a number of supplements that have been tried and that have been ineffective. And the last thing is, if a person is recommended to undergo low-dose CT scanning and they're a current smoker, that's the time we need to intervene to provide them counseling and pharmacotherapy.
A couple things I think are a little curious about these screening recs. One of them is that they say people who have 30-pack years of smoking or more. And to me, that seems like kind of an arbitrary number. Why don't we screen people with 25-pack years or 20-pack years, which is still a significant amount of cigarette smoking, at least in my view? I think we do have some data that would substantiate potentially increased screening in folks who don't meet that number of 30-pack years.
And what happens with the guidelines is they base it upon evidence. And the best evidence we have comes from the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial. And those were the criteria for getting into it. So if we're going to expand those criteria, we need to have evidence. And the nice thing is they update those based upon new evidence. So as that accrues, Elizabeth, we may expand it.
I think one of the other somewhat sobering aspects of this particular set of recs is the prognostication that if this is implemented, it should result in about a 20% reduction in lung cancer deaths, which seems fairly modest as far as I'm concerned for what's going to be a significant outlay.
You're right. One of the points that this paper makes is that screening is not a substitute for smoking cessation.
Indeed. And someone else I've spoken with about these particular recommendations said, wonder if we took all those dollars we're going to be spending for screening CT and put them into smoking intervention programs if we wouldn't end up with more bang for our buck.
That is some wise and sage advice. I totally agree. I think we're much better off preventing something than trying to detect it, especially if it's a deadly disease.
Since we're talking about prevention, then let's go to our final study that's also in the Journal of the American Medical Association, taking a look at preventing inappropriate shocks from implanted cardio defibrillators.
We're going to call those ICDs. And these are devices that are implanted just below the skin. And then from there, a lead goes into the heart, detects the rhythm. And if the person has a potentially lethal rhythm, it's meant to either pace them out of it. And if that doesn't work, it's meant to shock them out of that rhythm. Once we put these things in, we know that many individuals have inappropriate shocks. Here's an interesting fact we've gleaned over the last year, is that when a person gets shocked, it increases the risk of death and worsening heart failure. So the real question is, how can we prevent these inappropriate shocks? So this was a really interesting study that took about 1,900 individuals that had defibrillators. And half the individuals, they left them programmed, that is, to detect the arrhythmia, to shock the individuals in the standard way. And the other half, they reprogrammed this. We're going to let the rhythm go a little bit longer than normally. And we're going to make sure that it's at a faster rate before we shock. And then they followed those two groups of individuals for a year. And here's what they found out. In the people in which it was reprogrammed not to shock until we waited a little bit longer, they were much less likely to have inappropriate shocks. It did not make them more likely to faint. So I think this is a good news story. And when they looked at, did it shock appropriately? The answer is yes.
Well, this sounds like really good news to me because you and I have both heard plenty of people who have these devices say that getting shocked is really not a fun time at all.
No, if you're having a lethal arrhythmia, boy, you're really glad it works. However, if you're not having a lethal arrhythmia, if your heart's just going fast, or if you're in an arrhythmia that would stop on its own and you get a shock, it is really uncomfortable. And these people have post-traumatic stress disorder, they have psychological problems, and as I mentioned, they're at increased risk of future death.
And kudos to those folks who agreed to participate in it with this idea that there may have been a risk actually in having the device modified.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because this goes to what's called equipoise in studies. That is, you can't go in there with a preconceived idea. You can have a hypothesis, but you can't go in there saying, oh, this therapy will be good or bad because you don't really know.
Excellent. So, of course, I'm going to talk about the pacifier study this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.